It's 106. You're listening to the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. She'll be back next week. Well, as you just heard in the NPR newscast, President Obama has ruled out sending troops to fight on the ground in Iraq, but U.S. military troops have been deployed in Iraq to protect the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, and other options are being considered. We're going to talk about the situation in Iraq and specifically the militants from the so-called Islamic State of Iraq, Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or Islamic State in Iraq and Levant, as they're also known. They have continued to advance across Iraq toward Baghdad, and a lot of conflicting reports coming out of that part of the world. So we're going to talk about that this hour. We welcome your contributions as well at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. My guest this hour is Seth Jones, Associate Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. He's going to help us try to understand this group, ISIS, and talk about what, if any, potential U.S. involvement in this situation there should be. Seth Jones, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
It's great to be on. Thanks.
Well, a lot of moving parts here. Obviously, this is a, I guess you could call this situation fluid. It changes from hour to hour. We don't necessarily know who to believe and who not to believe. But why don't we start by, let's try and maybe flesh out a little bit who this Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, is, and what threat they pose.
Well, the origins of this organization actually go back to Afghanistan. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who U.S. forces killed several years ago, put together a group called Tawhid wal-Jihad in western Afghanistan in the Herat area. And then just before the U.S. invasion, he moved into Iraq in 2002, and then when the invasion started in 2003, started to conduct attacks against the U.S., U.S. allies, including the United Nations. And then in late 2004, he formed an alliance and pledged loyalty, or bayat, to al-Qaeda leaders in Pakistan. And at that point, it became al-Qaeda in Iraq. And then over the next several years, that group became much stronger up until about 2006 when the awakening happened. And that's the origins of this organization. Now, the interesting part is in early 2014, it was essentially kicked out of al-Qaeda by Ayman al-Zawahiri, by the leader back in Pakistan. But its origins date back over a decade to actually even pre-U.S. invasion.
So why were they kicked out of al-Qaeda?
Well, ironically, this is one of the few cases where a group has been too extreme, in a sense, for al-Qaeda itself. Even going back a decade, there were a number of letters that went back from al-Qaeda leaders in Pakistan to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi that they were killing too many Shia, that they were conducting too many gruesome beheadings, and that they were alienating the local population. That continued over the next several years, and it really came to a head last year, particularly when the core in Pakistan wanted another organization, Jabhat al-Nusra, to largely run al-Qaeda operations in Syria. And this group, what's now ISIS, said no. That's our territory, both Iraq and Syria. This was adjudicated by the al-Qaeda leadership in Pakistan. ISIS refused to accept the rulings of Zawahiri, the al-Qaeda leader, and he was tossed out of the organization. So a range of organizational and ideological issues led to their removal from al-Qaeda.
So what direct threat, if any, does this ISIS group pose to the United States?
Well, I think there are a couple of concerns. One is this group is deeply anti-American and deeply anti-Western. Its focus and goal is to establish a broader regional caliphate, an extremist caliphate, where it would end democratic rule to the degree that it exists in Iraq, and in its place established rule by Sharia or Islamic law. In particular, over the last year or so, there's been an increase in foreign fighters from both the United States, but particularly Europe, into Syria and to a lesser degree Iraq. And so ISIS has been able to build up fundraising from Europe and a little bit in the United States, fighters, recruitment, and recently concerns about operational plotting in the West. The French intelligence recently arrested somebody who had an ISIS background for assassinations in Brussels, Belgium. And there's been growing concern about ISIS interest in external attacks, particularly in Europe. So that definitely should be of concern. In addition, the fact that we have Americans going to this Syria-Iraq fight, and in the case of one individual from Florida blowing himself up as a suicide bomber, directly touches the United States.
800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have a question or you'd like to make a comment on our topic. We're talking about the situation in Iraq and specifically the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or Islamic State in Iraq and Levant, as it's known. And Tim on Facebook writes, can your guest explain what Levant is and where does that term come from?
Sure. The Levant really refers to the broader area around in the Middle East, around Iraq, Lebanon, Syria. For many in this organization, they refer to it as al-Sham, and it goes into the really to the Mediterranean. And actually, what's interesting is the reason this organization calls itself the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham is because their view over the next several years to establish a broader regional caliphate, much broader than just in Iraq or even just Syria. It's a – and this goes back to the dispute we had with al-Qaeda that I spoke about a couple of minutes ago. It's a broader regional focus on the Levant or al-Sham, which includes, you know, chunks of Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, et cetera.
Now, you mentioned that this organization's been around since before the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Why is ISIS grabbing U.S. attention and concern right now?
Well, they've been grabbing U.S. attention for the past several years. Since the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq in 2011, ISIS has been conducting growing numbers of attacks in both Syria as well as in Iraq in particular. And so U.S. Intelligence agencies have no doubt been monitoring growing trends in the levels of violence by ISIS. But what has been particularly concerning recently is the efforts by the organization along with other Sunni groups. This is not just an ISIS problem. I think the media often misconstrues this. It is a much broader Sunni issue. ISIS, along with Naqshbandis, the JRTN, some former officers of the Saddam Hussein regime, started taking control of at least parts of cities in northern Iraq, in Tal Afar and Mosul, and then moving down the Tigris River, and then also in parts of western Iraq, Haditha, down into the Ramadi and Fallujah areas, and then putting pressure on Baghdad. So they have moved from conducting attacks and controlling some neighborhoods to making an effort with Sunni allies to essentially establish a blitzkrieg strategy to take control of all or parts of cities.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program. You can also send an email, talk@wpr.org. One of the things that the President Obama commented on was that the Iraqi security forces have, to say the least, been unable to defend a number of cities in Iraq, and particularly in spite of the fact that they outnumbered the people who were attacking them. We've spent a lot of money training and supplying these security forces in Iraq, and the president was pretty clear. He said, hey, if they're not going to defend themselves, there's really not much we can do. Why is it that these Iraqi security forces have been unable or unwilling to defend their country from these insurgents?
Well, one of the reasons, and this is why there is a deep-seated political aspect, not just a military one, to Iraq right now. There has been growing unhappiness, grievances with the Maliki government, particularly from Sunnis who believe they have been alienated. This has not happened overnight. Animosity has been building among Sunnis for the last several years, in part since Maliki actually took power. And so what it has done in some degree is fractured part of the Iraqi security forces. So with well-equipped, well-armed rebels that have taken funding, fighters, weapons from Syria and moved them into Iraq, and with such a fractured political process and deep animosity, particularly among the Sunni, with the Maliki government, the security forces have disintegrated. So that is, in a sense, the problem. This is not just a training, advising, and assisting effort and building competent security forces, because the U.S. did put a lot of money into that. It's in part caused by political fissures within Iraq, including the security apparatus.
Well, and you still – I mean, ultimately, isn't this isn't this a religious war? I was reading an article. Someone compared the Sunni-Shia conflict to what was going on in the Reformation period, with the constant warfare back and forth between Protestants and Catholics in Europe. This is ultimately a religious conflict, is it not?
Well, it's many things. It's often talked about as a sectarian conflict between Sunni and Shia. And there's certainly some element of truth there. We've had religious figures on both the Sunni and Shia sides, including Sistani, that have called their respective Sunni and Shia militia forces and fighters to action against the other. But it's a much more complicated picture than that. If we go back to the awakening in 2006, when ISIS in its previous form tried to do something similar in provinces like Al-Anbar, a chunk of the fighting was not Sunni-Shia but was intra-Sunni. It was among Sunni tribes that were fighting with ISIS. It was Muslim Brotherhood organizations like the 1920 Revolution Brigades that were fighting with ISIS. It was known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq at that time. But then you also have ethnic dimensions. You have a Kurdish minority up in the north that wants more autonomy, if not independence. And so it's not just a religious issue. It's an ethnic one as well. And that's what makes this situation complicated, is you've got multiple different parts of the onion here.
Well, it is. There are a lot of moving parts to this, which always makes trying to encapsulate this in a one-hour talk show it almost sounds foolish, because it would take us days to parse all of this out. We'll do the best we can, however. We're talking about the situation in Iraq, specifically the actions of ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or Islamic State in Iraq and Levant, as the president referred to it. President Obama just conducted a news conference at the White House. He said, "We're not sending troops to fight in Iraq. There are troops there to protect the American embassy in Baghdad." But he ruled out sending troops, but he said that other means are being discussed. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, Seth Jones, let's talk about what our options are and as a practical matter, what it's even possible for the United States to do in Iraq if we rule out sending in ground forces. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program, 800-642-1234. talk@wpr.org is our email address, and you can always find the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and leave a comment or question there. My guest is Seth Jones, Associate Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation and Adjunct Professor at Johns Hopkins University School for Advanced International Studies. We'll be back with more with Seth Jones and your calls and questions in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour on the Kathleen Dunn program, we're talking with Seth Jones, Associate Director of the International Security Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation, an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins University School for Advanced International Studies, about the situation in Iraq, trying to find out more about this Islamic State in Iraq and Syria organization, which obviously has been heavily involved in the Syrian civil war and which has seemingly boiled over into Iraq. They're advancing on Baghdad. There are serious concerns about the future of the Iraqi government based on their failure so far to get troops to stand up to this group. So what is the United States supposed to do about this? People are looking at us saying, okay, what are you going to do? The president met with congressional leaders Wednesday to discuss military options. Today, in his news conference, he ruled out troops on the ground. So, Seth Jones, I ask you, if we take sending troops off the table, what options do we have left, and how likely are they to be successful?
Well, I think anything at this point is going to be difficult to change quickly on the ground in Iraq. But the U.S. does have options. Again, how well and how quickly these can change the picture on the ground is somewhat unclear. On the political side, the U.S. State Department diplomats certainly have their hands full on trying to ensure the resolution of key political grievances, particularly among Sunnis but also among Kurds. To try to promote and encourage a more inclusive power-sharing arrangement and a consensus government. The question, as the Saudis, among others, have brought up, is will that include Maliki in the future? Should he remain as the Iraqi leader? I mean, that's not one that I think the U.S. should get directly involved in. That's one that the Iraqi population needs to figure out. But there's a political settlement. The intelligence community, the U.S. and other organizations in the region, you know, also have a role to play in collection of information and potentially reaching out to allies. But the big question is on the military side. And the president said that he would not get U.S. forces involved in fighting in Afghanistan, in Iraq. But that leaves open a number of options. There are airstrikes that are being discussed at the moment from fixed wing airplanes, helicopters, unmanned aerial vehicles. There would be the collection of intelligence from military assets, including drones, but other kinds of airborne surveillance, efforts to train, advise, and assist Iraqi forces, including ministries, and then efforts to equip the Iraqi forces. So there are some things certainly on the table that the U.S. could provide, particularly training, advice, and assistance to Iraqi forces that they need. I mean, basically, the issue is to cobble together some kind of Iraqi force plus Sunni allies to push back the ISIS and its Sunni constituency. And I think that's reasonable. Question is whether you want to get directly involved with airstrikes.
Is ISIS capable, militarily capable, of taking Baghdad? And if they do, what does that mean for the Middle East?
Well, it's probably worth remembering in Iraq that the Sunni are a minority. This is a Shia majority state, and so ISIS is going to be have a very difficult time controlling and particularly holding large amounts of land, particularly in cities like Baghdad. And furthermore, ISIS itself, according to some recent assessments, has roughly on the order of magnitude of 10,000 fighters. It has to rely on other Sunni organizations like the Islamic Army of Iraq, the Naqshbandis, some of the Saddam Hussein former officers, Baathists that have been involved. It cannot do it alone. And that leaves ISIS over the long run quite vulnerable. It doesn't have the numbers to control, and it doesn't have the majority of the population. But it still poses a major threat. It's gotten a lot of money. It's gotten some heavy weapons and equipment and overrunning some Iraqi security forces, including bases. So it is and its allies are quite threatening. And I think the concern is that there is a lot of opportunity for bloodshed over the next several weeks and months and potentially even years. But again, I think ISIS is going to have a very hard time holding territory that it controls, certainly by itself.
800-642-1234. Let's take a call from David in Ironwood. David, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, I saw a thing on public TV explaining Sharia law. It sounds like Muslims, most of the religions have a central authority. And the way this gal was saying that the whole Muslim does not. They have schools of thought. And so Sharia law can differ depending on what school of theological thought. Although it looks like this ISIS wants to make it monolithic and spread their particular school of thought to all Muslims. So these other Muslims who, if they don't like this, well, heck, you got the Sunni and the, what I call it. But I hope their hatred for the Shiite and the Sunni doesn't realize they might wake up and find out that they end up with a lot worse with this ISIS in control.
David, thanks for the call. Again, we talked about this earlier. There are so many different, I hate to even call them factions, but so many different takes on how to, you know, different points of view within the Muslim community on this. It really makes it difficult to even figure out who's who.
Yeah, David's question is a very good one. The point here is that ISIS in Iraq and also which has been involved in the Syria war is an extremist organization. Its interpretation of Sharia and actually how to get there through the use of violence is a minority within Islam. It's generally not been popular among most individuals that have come into contact with most Muslims in Iraq and Syria, and frankly is one of its most significant vulnerabilities. There's not a lot of populist support for ISIS's ideology. The rough parallel, and there are notable differences, is if listeners remember what the Taliban regime did in Afghanistan in the 1990s up until September 11th, 2001, and then its overthrow by U.S. and allied forces. Its version of Sharia was deeply repressive. Women were not allowed to work. Individuals that listened to music were pulled out of their cars and executed or beaten. And what we've seen with ISIS in areas that it controls in Iraq and Syria is mass executions in some cases. There's been growing concern within the United Nations of rote brutality, potentially human rights abuses by ISIS based on sheer numbers. They've conducted beheadings. So areas they control, the type of Sharia that they institute, mandate, is about the most extremist version of Sharia we have seen anywhere in the modern era. And it is, again, it is generally not particularly popular both within Syria and within Iraq, which indicates that what they've done recently is able to take advantage of numbers, hatred against the Maliki government, and an infusion of funds and weapons rather than large-scale popularity.
Much of President Obama's comments today called on the leaders of Iraq to be willing to make tough decisions on compromises on behalf of the Iraqi people. From what you can tell, does President Obama have any confidence in the Iraqi leadership with regards to its ability to deal with ISIS?
Well, the biggest question is, does the U.S. administration and do other countries in the region have confidence that Maliki will make the necessary political changes within Iraq to acquiesce many of the Sunnis who have supported at least a revolt against the Maliki government? And that's unclear right now. In fact, ironically, the most influential broker in the region is Iran. Maliki is, and much of the Iraqi government is Shia. It's the majority population in Iraq. Iran is the largest, or perhaps the largest, foreign donor. They've got a close relationship, although not a perfect one, with the Maliki government. And so part of the issue is the U.S. and the Iranians have been talking about political resolution in Iraq and the future of Maliki. I think that's the issue. It's less dealing with ISIS per se and more trying to deal with the root causes of what's just happened. And that's less an ISIS issue and more a Sunni one.
Well, you know, when I look at this sometimes, it really seems like we're continually trying to pound a round peg into a square hole. The borders that were drawn after World War I in the Middle East, at the very minimum, they're artificial. They don't really reflect what the culture was on the ground at that point and who the people were that they were trying to divide politically. And by that I mean just drawing lines on a map and saying, okay, you're Iraqis now and you're Syrians and you're Lebanese and you're Jordanians. We have these artificial borders. The idea that there is an Iraqi nation sometimes seems it's a little mystifying because there just really doesn't seem to be one. And why should we keep expecting one to emerge?
Well, John, that's a good question. One could say the same thing about a lot of countries, including even in that region, countries like Lebanon. The challenge, though, is there's no neat answer to trying to redraw lines in a country like Iraq. There are neighborhoods and cities, let alone regions, where there's a mixture of Sunni and Shia. And even if one decided to encourage the independence of some of the ethnic groups like the Kurds, well, the Kurdish community transcends borders. They've got a large population in neighboring countries like Turkey. So the question is, well, if you're going to redraw boundaries and give the Turks an independence or the Kurds an independent state, where do you draw that boundary? And so the problem is if we get into the business of trying to redraw boundaries, they're just simply not clear along ethnic and religious lines. And I think that causes more problems than it does solve them. The Kurds will be unhappy. The Shia, the Sunni will be unhappy. And so, again, I'd be very careful about trying to re-social engineer this area, including borders, because, again, I don't think there's a neat answer here.
Well, and I guess I wasn't – I didn't mean to suggest that we should redraw the map. I guess what I was reaching for was when – in the United States, when we look at the situation over there, we look at it through the lens of what we have here in the United States, which – right now, we're probably as divided a country as we've been in a long time. But essentially, we know, you know, kind of who we are and who we're with. And though we may disagree, we're still all Americans. We have a national identity. And so when we look at a situation like Syria or Iraq, we don't necessarily understand why, okay, well, you know, why can't they just be Iraqis? And I guess what I'm aiming at is we need to understand that the situation over there is not like it is here.
That's right. It's not. It's not like it is here. There is, and I think in particular since the overthrow of the Saddam Hussein regime in 2003, the sense of an Iraqi identity has given way to multiple identities at a national, at a regional, at a local, and even a neighborhood level, even below cities and towns. And so in that sense, people have to understand that the war itself, caused in part by the U.S. overthrow of Saddam, has caused people to sort of self-identify along multiple lines, along ethnic lines like Kurds, along religious lines in some cases like Sunni and Shia, and even along militia lines, even within the Shia community. Some Shia are allied with individuals like Muqtada al-Sadr and support either him directly or his militia forces. So yes, it is a very deeply polarized society. And when you have over a decade of warfare and blood that's been shed, it reinforces that level of polarization. So, in our history, in the American history, we've had periods of this during the Civil War, during, the 1960s to some degree. We had a polarized society, not quite at this level, but it is very different. There is not the sense of national unity, and people do need to understand that, especially when the U.S. is considering wading in some capacity to this.
Let's take a call from Robert in De Pere next. Robert, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I just tuned into the show a couple of minutes ago, so this may have already been discussed, so I apologize if that's the case. Just by way of identification, I am myself a professor of Middle East history at St. Norbert College, so I've been following this conversation and the issue with great interest. I would agree with a lot of the things that your guest has said, but I would, I guess, just underline one point, and that would be that there is an extremely deep strain of Islamist thought that is not just found in Iraq, but indeed, obviously, throughout the region. And it goes back before Al-Qaeda, before Osama bin Laden, even before the founder of the Muslim Brothers, Hassan al-Banna, in the 1930s. And this is something that really, in one way or another, shapes the way a lot of Muslim people, not only Sunnis but Shiites as well, think about themselves and about the world around them. So one of the problems I think we have as a country is we tend to look at groups like ISIS or ISIL, whatever you want to refer to it as a discrete entity. And I think it's not. I think like Al-Qaeda, whose name, as you probably know, means the base, we're talking about groupings of people that make and remake themselves continuously, change their names continuously, and what they're expressing is a fairly profoundly established, historically established sense of what it means to be a Muslim, a correct Muslim. And because the borders make no sense, and because there are issues that have been unresolved for so long, having to do with borders and political rule and, of course, Palestine and that issue. These things come up time and time again in new iterations. And I think the notion of America having a military role to play is a mistake, and I think it repeats the mistake of earlier interventions, because it suggests that we can go in and there is a discrete enemy and that we can identify them, we can find them, we can spot them, we can take them out with an airstrike. I don't think that's the case. I think we can take out a group, but we can't take out something that is, again, a profoundly ingrained sense of what it means to be a Muslim without a broader conversation among all parties about what exactly it is they're looking for. Now, this is not to say that we need to sit down with these people and have a conversation per se, but there has to be at some level some kind of dialogue, because we can't simply go in there and take them out and expect the problem to go away. It's not going to go away.
Robert, thanks for the call. Seth Jones?
Robert's points were excellent, and I agree across the board with one potential issue that I'll get to in a second. But I think certainly true, as he outlines, that even though ISIS itself has its origins as an organization specifically in the Tawhid wal-Jihad that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi established and then set up training camps in western Afghanistan – while the Taliban was still there and then brought that organization to Iraq before that invasion. And this is a remnant itself of that organization. Robert is definitely right that this does reflect a much older and deeper debate that's been influenced by a whole number of clerics, of people that have written books, of commanders in various places of these organizations. On the military role, I would say, it's a question about whether, in addition to political aspects of this, and that is, there are very specific root causes of this particular blitzkrieg by ISIS and some of the other Sunni groups like the JRTN, the Naqshbandis, in Iraq today. And they do have very specific center of gravity in grievances against the Maliki government. But in addition to steps to deal with those political issues, there is a question, I would say, about in order to push these organizations back, would at least limited assistance to the Iraqi security forces, the army, the police, even in the sense of training, advising, and equipment, not engagement on the ground in combat, but would that be helpful? And the issue is, and if not by the Americans, by, you know, would it be helpful by somebody else? The issue is those security forces have collapsed. At this point, the response is to put together Shia and Sunni tribal sub-state actors to respond. I think ultimately you need a national-level response by the Iraqi government. And if, in addition to political, economic, and other steps, their assistance can be helpful in rebuilding the Iraqi security forces, I would say that's one area that might be considered. And because I think it would be quite dangerous for this situation to actually get worse, to see more cities or parts of cities fall.
Seth Jones, we need to take a break. When we come back, we have more callers who want to join us and some Facebook comments to get to as well. We're talking about the situation in Iraq, learning a little more about the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, as they're called, or the Islamic State in Iraq and Levant, as the president referred to them. Either way, we're talking about that with Seth Jones, Associate Director of the International Security Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation, and with you at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org or through the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show, we're talking about the situation in Iraq with Seth Jones and with you as well. We'll go back to the phones, take a call from Mark in Richland Center. Mark, hello.
Hello, John. You raised the issue, and then the professor that called in also mentioned the illegitimacy of the borders in the region. You specified that they came into existence after World War I, but you didn't mention that they came into existence after the discovery of oil in the region. So all of this talk about religious animosity amongst groups, if one is really to understand all of this, why are we not talking about the fact that the borders were established with monarchs or whoever we put in charge in those various supposed countries in order to take the resources that were there and simply hyping up the religious animosity amongst groups, even if that means weaponizing the groups because they don't have their own weapons manufacturing capabilities? So all of this religious talk is absolute bullshit. The reason why we're there is to take the resources. And the countries are designed, are established that way, and yet we're talking about in this kind of smoke and mirrors diversion about this religious differences between groups and not mentioning one damn word about taking resources, and that's the whole reason why this entire region has been colonized.
Mark, thanks for the call. Seth Jones?
Resource issue is an important one. There are a number of natural resources, including oil in Iraq. And in fact, one of the things that was interesting to watch most recently with the ISIS move into Mosul and then into areas of Anbar province is the response by Kurdish forces, including the Peshmerga, were to retain control of their oil facilities very quickly and to put out security forces to protect their oil centers. The Kurds actually have profited quite a bit from their control of oil resources in parts of northern and northeastern Iraq. So oil is an important issue. I mean, do foreign governments in the West profit from oil? Not really. I mean, the vast majority of profits, and this has caused some grievances within Iraq, have come either from local entities like the Kurds that control chunks of territory where oil is extracted, or the Iraqi government itself, which has led to concerns and accusations of corruption and which has further undermined grievances with the Maliki government. So, I mean, there is a broader interest across the board in this region in the Middle East and in the Gulf because of oil and oil production. But if you look at the last several years, the vast majority of individuals that have profited from oil have been very specific individuals from the region, not Western states, and certainly not others. It's very specific ethnic groups like the Kurds or small sort of crony capitalist individuals that control some of the oil trade. But this conversation, this subject is quite important, and this is a strategic issue in this region.
Well, here's a comment from Kay on Facebook. Kay writes, "The Shiites and Sunnis in Iraq had no problem warring with Iran in the 1980s. This sectarianism is a Western-created rift. Let's be honest. Let's not frame this conflict as a sectarian war occurring in a vacuum." Seth Jones?
I am quite sure, and I've done this myself in the region, when you ask local Shia and Sunni whether this warfare is a Western creation, they have laughed, and they would laugh at that answer. No, this is a very serious issue for them, and there's been sectarianism on and off for a very long time that preceded the Iraq-Iran war. I mean, that was in part a state-centric war. Since the overthrow of the Saddam regime, there's been further polarization, including after the U.S. Left in 2011. But we see sectarian fighting in multiple other locations, in Syria, where there's been really no Western role, in Lebanon, where there's been certainly no major Western role. We've seen bombings perpetrated either by Hezbollah and Shia that are allied with Hezbollah, as well as in some of the Sunni entities that exist, and even Christian entities that exist in Lebanon. So there's the broader sectarian dimensions, I would argue, have little to do per se with Western creations, though they may be affected by Western decisions like the U.S. decision to invade in 2003 in Iraq.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Still time for you to get in on the program. Let's go to La Pointe. And George is with us. George, hello.
Hello. John, this is the best program that I've heard covering this issue, both in radio and television and nationally and internationally, including the BBC. Thank you very much. Now, a couple of comments. One, read The Seven Pillars of Wisdom by a guy by the name of Lawrence. He wrote it a number of years ago, around World War I, when he was the Western leader who brought together the various groups to throw out the Ottoman Empire. And I don't know if anybody in the State Department or RAND has read The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, but they should. A second book called Paris 1919 by Macmillan talks about the awareness of Winston Churchill and the leaders of France and England in being aware that their navies must have oil, and the only place for oil at that time was in the Middle East. And so they built these artificial nations purposely so that anybody would rule or try and rule would require British or French military force to keep them in power. And that's why Iraq is not a nation and never has been a nation. There have been three nations there, if you want to speak about nations. But then you need to go back and read Lawrence, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, Lawrence of Arabia, the movie, right? So you have some understanding of what that area is really about with the sectarian Sunni, Shiite, and Kurds. And Iraq was set up artificially to keep them dependent. Syria was set up artificially to keep them dependent upon French and English military support in order to remain in power. And as long as they competed with each other and hated each other, they needed French and English military power to stay in. Thirdly, where is the money from the oil in Iraq going? It is going to Halliburton, who does not take out oil, but who provides equipment to take out the oil. And that fact has been mentioned in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, that Halliburton has been the big benefactor in the Western world, i.e. the United States, from the oil in Iraq. And, of course, who was the CEO, the big man in Halliburton? A guy by the name of Cheney, who happened to be the vice president who was extremely influential in getting us to evade the artificial nation called Iraq.
George, thanks for your call and your comments. Seth Jones, a lot to chew on there.
Yeah, George is right to point out some excellent books. In fact, I teach several of them in my Johns Hopkins classes at the School for Advanced International Studies, including T. E. Lawrence or Lawrence of Arabia's books, particularly Seven Pillars of Wisdom, but some of his other writings as well. He was someone quite interesting because of his involvement, particularly with the British, in not just what is now Iraq, but a huge chunk of that area of the Middle East. And actually what's interesting, too, is you see the fissures at multiple levels that Lawrence of Arabia dealt with, that T.E. Lawrence dealt with. And so going back to books, there have been a number of books on Lawrence of Arabia written recently, including one called Lawrence in Arabia that was reviewed quite well by the Washington Post and several other books that are, I strongly agree with George, that are worth going back. You know, what's interesting actually about oil, just to add one additional element, and that is probably not surprisingly, it's one of the areas that ISIS has gone to quickly. In addition to attempting to control key cities such as Mosul, threatening now cities like Baghdad, it has pushed on to oil refineries, and in fact has control or is attempting to get control of several areas, including the Beji refinery, which is about 160 miles north of the capital, Baghdad. But ISIS has gone right for the jugular, right for the money flows. They've gone for bank accounts that they've taken as they've taken over banks in several of the cities that they've occupied. But they're also now going for oil refineries, and they do understand this is a potential source of income. So setting aside the whole Western, including Western corporations, there is a very, very strong effort underfoot by ISIS and some of the Sunni insurgents now to control the oil fields so that they'll reap the benefits. And that actually obviously gives them a lot of money. It gives them power, money that they can use to buy weapons, fighters, pay off fighters, and other things. So we're moving in a very, very precarious situation in Iraq, with but particularly with the control of oil refineries.
Seth Jones, if someone from the Obama administration were to reach out to you and say, "Hey, we could use a little help here. What should we do?" What would you tell them?
I would say, first of all, what are, if any, American national security interests? I think that's the most important question to ask. Should we get involved? Should we even care? And I do think what is of particular concern with this region, and something that we've got to at least acknowledge, is the sheer number of foreign fighters that have gone to this area to fight. This is the largest jihadist battlefield we have seen since at least the 1980s. And the fact that we have Americans in particular going to Iraq and Syria to fight is of concern, to the degree now that we've got Americans, at least one so far very recently, who blew himself up. That's of concern, because if this region continues down this direction of instability and we have Americans and Europeans that go fight and then come back, as we've seen, and conduct either assassinations or plots, that's something I do think begins to affect the U.S. homeland. But I would say if we've learned one lesson from the past decade or so, it is counterproductive for U.S. ground forces to get involved in these kinds of wars. It acts as a lightning rod for religion. And so I would say it's worth getting engaged in political efforts to solve some of the grievances. There may be a role for the U.S. to play in providing some limited assistance to the Iraqi security forces, but I would not put U.S. combat troops on the ground.
Seth Jones, thank you so much for helping bring some clarity to what is certainly a very messy picture for us this afternoon. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Seth Jones, Associate Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation and Adjunct Professor at Johns Hopkins University School for Advanced International Studies. KP Whaley produced this hour of programming. We had on-air production support from Dave Potrantz and Jennifer Dargan. Cynthia Schuster was the director for this hour. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.